Greetings and salutations, and welcome to Radio Days, a podcast radio program that delves into the world of terrestrial radio. It's DJs and on-air personality, and you, all fans of radio as a medium. Here's your host, Ron.
Hello, and welcome to episode 4 of season 4 of Radio Days, the podcast. Very excited about today's show, as I have a Mount Rushmore-worthy radio personality on the program. He's one of the best ever to open up the mic, boys and girls. But before I bring him in, I want to let you know that you can hear this podcast on Buzzsprout, as well as all major podcast platforms like Spotify, Apple, Google Podcasts. You can also watch this podcast via YouTube and at ronrobinsonstudios.com as well. Radio Days, the podcast, is sponsored by Radio Days 101 Years of Radio, which is a new documentary, a series, as a matter of fact, about the history of terrestrial radio. Hear the story from those who lived it. Dick Purton, Greg Russell, Doug Podell, Duke Fakur, JoJo Shuddy McGregor, Ken Calvert, Jill Forsyth, Art Regner, Paul W. Smith are just a few of the scores of radio personalities and historians who appear in this docuseries. You can catch the entire five-part documentary on the free streaming service Reveal, which is R-E-V-E-E-L, or on Vimeo. And for that, you can find the link and more information on my website, ronrobinsonstudios.com. My guest today is a Detroit radio legend. Really doesn't need an introduction, but I'm going to give him one anyway. He's been heard on WROV in Virginia, WAAF in Boston, KMXX in Phoenix, but he is best known for his time here in Detroit radio. Of course, you learned about him at WRIF, and he's also, for the last several years, been at the helm for one of the most downloaded radio podcasts in the country. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome the incomparable Mr. Drew Lane. Drew, thanks for coming on the show. How are you, sir?
I'm great, Ron, and I apologize. I remember the first time you initially asked me to come on, you were working on your documentary, and I've somehow put this off so many times that the documentary is done.
Yeah, it is done. Well, you weren't the only one, because I there was like 10 more people on my list, including yourself, that I wanted to interview. But I got some the late Ken Calvert says, Ron, you got to stop and just make your movie. You just got to stop. And in fact, he was the last. He said that because he was the last person I interviewed. I'm sure there was some selfish reasons. But no, I could have. Maybe I'll do a part two, because I would have loved to have you in this docuseries. It's pretty cool.
So who else was really difficult to get? I'm just curious what category I'm in.
Paul W. Smith was difficult.
Okay.
But mostly people who are still doing it. You know what I mean? You're still doing it via a podcast, but I mean, you're busy. I mean, you're busy to this day. What's an average week like for you look like these days?
Well, right now we're doing generally about 4 shows a week, and they're 2.5 hours to 3 hours.
Wow.
So that's a lot of content to churn out.
Yeah.
Now, back in the radio days, that's nothing. It's like you did 4.5 to 5 hours a day, 5 days a week, and you're expected to do 5 days. Podcasting, I don't know, we're a podcast that's still kind of like a radio show. I think people like it for that reason, because it sounds familiar. It moves around topic to topic, very topical. I don't think most podcasts are like that. Even the really popular ones tend to be, you know, a couple comedians just riffing for an hour. Or, you know, a guest fills up an hour.
Well, I mean, back when Drew and Mike was on Riff, I mean, you guys, it would be nothing for you guys to be still on the air at 11:30 sometimes.
That's true. 11:30 was really pushing it. Podell would get very annoyed by 11:30. But, yeah, we did go overtime a lot. So
right.
I guess I'm good at pushing out lots of content, and hopefully people still like it. We've been podcasting almost 8 years now.
Wow.
Wow. I know.
And there's lots of questions in so little time. So before we get into your career, Drew, I want to go back to a very young Drew Lane. What were you listening to on the radio when you were growing up?
WLS and WCFL in Chicago, and WIND, WMAQ carried the Blackhawks, WIND carried the Bulls, and I used to listen to a talk show after that that Dave Baum did on WIND. But CFL and LS played hit radio, Larry Lujack. Eventually, when things really got crazy, Steve Dahl was on WLS in the afternoon with Gary Meyer, and Larry Lujack was on in the morning. And just a little side note, they battled because Dahl and Meyer made fun of Lujack all the time. And one day, Lujack came in to confront them on their afternoon show, and they ended up walking out. interviewing Lou Jack in their show.
Wow.
By himself.
Wow.
So that was, there was some great radio in Chicago. I thought Jonathan Brandmeier, Kevin Matthews, Stephen Gary, those were great, great, great shows.
So were you drawn to the personalities or the medium of radio and the theater of the mind, or a little bit of both that kind of captured your imagination as a young age?
I think both. I listened to a lot of sports, of course, but I think hearing Steve Dahl was the first thing that really gave me the idea that, wow, doing a morning show would be exciting as hell. I mean, it sounded like a mountain of work, but at the same time, it sounded like a lot of fun. It sounded like a lot of playtime.
Right. Well, when you say Steve Dahl, I mean, when I was a kid, I remember listening to him before he left Detroit, and it would be nothing for him just to be on the air for 2 or 3 minutes just eating his cereal. I mean,
he was really unique. And I think Steve Dahl actually deserves more credit than he gets, because I think at one point Stern said, oh, Steve Dahl, he stole my act. And I don't think that's true at all. I think Dahl was before Howard.
Yeah.
And Dahl was doing, a talk show, a young person's talk show on FM before Howard Stern.
Right on.
And so Disco Demolition happened before Stern was even a name people knew.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I've talked to several people. I mean, Stern, even at his popularity, he wasn't like a Detroit guy. People from Detroit, you know, at first it was JJ and then you and Drew and Mike. You guys owned Howard in the Detroit market, which I always thought was interesting.
Yeah, that was, that was quite a Spectre hangover. Lila, shut up! Lila, stop it. My dog, there's some...
She wants to be on the show, Drew. She wants to be on the show, I think.
She does. That some car alarm is going off, and I'm like, oh no, I know she's going to start barking sooner or later. She probably won't stop until, God, it's been going off for about a minute now. Anyway, I'm sorry, what were we talking about? Howard, yeah. The specter of Howard Stern was huge, because he not only beat people, he just destroyed them. You know what he did to John DiBella in Philadelphia? I think he broke that marriage up. He didn't break it up, but he had his wife on Dial-A-Date on his show after they divorced or during their divorce. She eventually committed suicide. Oh, I mean, yeah, it was really insane. And I thought, oh shit, Howard Stern, I hope it doesn't happen. It can't possibly happen. And then it happened. And then amazingly, the Red Wings were on their Stanley Cup run in 97, I believe, when he came on. And I think that was so huge here that he was busy promoting his movie, Private Part. And I think, honestly, it wasn't a good time for him to sign on in Detroit, and it was a great time for us.
And there's lots to talk about. I don't want to get too ahead of ourselves, but I want to ask you, before we get into your career as a radio, talk about your first off, how did you know, it's one thing to be a fan of radio, but when and how did you say, okay, you know what, I want to do this as a profession? Talk me through that, if you would.
Well, I studied communications in college, and I didn't really know what that meant or what that would lead to. But I worked at WUVT, and we did a sports talk show. And I think I got really comfortable with being on the air, because we didn't play music. We just talked about Virginia Tech sports, mostly football and basketball. And I was playing baseball, so we talked a little bit about that, too. And then I did music shows on WBT also, where you could pick your music, which is like, that's the last time I ever did that. But that's really where I guess I got the bug, although I always loved radio. And then the message that everyone sent, I mean, even instructors or professors would say, oh, you can't make any money on radio. Nobody makes money on radio. And when I started working in really small stations, radio and records would be sitting around, and I'd read about the Grease Man signed a 4-year contract for $500,000. Steve Dahl signed a big contract. And I thought, well, you can't. Some people make money in radio. Right. So I thought it was worth a try.
Yeah. Well, so what was your first job in radio?
Actually, commercial radio was WFIC in Collinsville, Virginia. I took a job selling for a corrugated box company, which was a good job with benefits and company car and stuff. And I still loved radio, but I'd been so fed this thing, oh, you can't make any money on the air, you have to be in sales, that I just took this job knowing it was probably a better job than I can get radio. So WFIC was in the town I lived in, Collinsville, which is a tiny, tiny town. And this was 1510 a.m. And honestly, beyond the block it was on, I don't know anyone who ever heard me on WFIC. It was so small. I can't imagine how they paid people, honestly. And they were a what was known as a daytimer, their license allowed them to be on from sunup to sundown.
Right.
So when I was
back then, you had to have a license, right, just to be on the air, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, you had to have an FCC license. You had to pass a test. And in the winter months, they actually, in the summer months, I should say, I'd be on from like, I think it was 6 to 8:45, and then you turn off the transmitter. And then in the winter months, they would actually make me come in and do 5 to 5:30 or something, because the other guy's shift was over. I was like, oh my God, I have to come in and do a half an hour. How stupid. But I did, because I wanted to put in some hours there.
So you were coming on at 5, and you were turning on the mic from static, right?
No, 5 in the afternoon.
Oh, okay.
After selling boxes all day.
Okay, I misheard that. I'm sorry. Yeah.
Yeah, just to be on for a half an hour, which is ridiculous. But anyway, I did it, and I'd work weekends and fly it. Is that alarm still going off? No, it's not. Lila, cool off. Chill out, baby. So, yeah, that was an interesting experience. And, you know, I produced commercials there and stuff like that. And my friends there were really my best friends, because I was so interested in radio and just that world in general. That really was my world. Selling boxes was something I did to pay the bills and to make some money. And after that, I went to my territory involved Blacksburg, Virginia, which is where I went to school at Virginia Tech. So I moved back there and I started filling in at V105, which was the big FM station that served the college town. And the 7 to midnight job came open and they were like, hey, why don't you take that? I mean, you know, you love this and you should do it. And my friends that worked there had gone to Virginia Tech too. And I'm like, God, it pays after taxes, like $113 a week.
Right, not much.
And not much at all. And I was making a couple grand a month, and I had a company car. And finally, I was doing both. I took the job. I would work my territory, rush back at 7, be on the air till midnight, go home, watch Letterman, and wake up. And it was really getting tiring. And eventually, I just said, I'm going to do this full time. I quit my safe job, turned in the company car, and decided I'm going to give this a shot. And I was 22 years old, and I moved to the morning show pretty quickly. And then somebody heard me. I used to do the post-game show for Virginia Tech football, which was actually a big audience because you had 60,000 people leaving the game.
Right.
And they'd call in, and it was a fun show to do. And they were a good team at the time. So somebody from WROV heard me on that show and said, hey, do you want to try, the big time of Roanoke, Virginia, which was, you know, maybe market 100, maybe I think it was market 99. They merged with Lynchburg and they were like, oh, we're top 100 market. So I started working part-time there, full-time in Blacksburg. Jesus. Lila, stop it.
That's just great.
Cut out.
This is why radio is great. This is good. My podcasts are great.
So then I'm going to go. Got to tend to this dog. Lila, stop it. Stop it, baby. It's okay. Just to get the last word in. So I went to Roanoke, and that quickly became full-time from part-time. And then they had a guy, Steve McFarland, who had worked in New Orleans and San Francisco. And he'd worked in 3 or 4 pretty big markets, I think. And Steve had come back because his father wasn't well. And they hired him to do the morning show. And Steve did a real personality morning show with character voices and bits. And I was doing middays. And Steve knew I was a big sports guy. And he's like, why don't you come in for the morning show and do sports? And, we'll pay you a little bit more. It was a terrible deal for me. I was on the air from like 6 a.m. till 2 p.m. because I did midday.
Wow, that's an 8-hour shift, man.
Yeah, it was. But I loved what I got to do in the morning show. It was the most fun because he had the freedom to do it. He'd worked in big markets. And I learned a lot from Steve. And then eventually Steve left, of course, as he was going to do when his father passed away. And he got a job in Cincinnati, which, you know, sounded like the big time to me. So I took over the morning show there. And then that became about a 2-year fight to get to a decent sized market, just sending out tapes, you know, repeatedly and getting better, and finally got a job in Charlotte. And I remember driving to Charlotte for the first time for the interview. And it's like, wow, this city has 70 story buildings. This is city. And it was really exciting. And, I remember the pay was $35,000. And I was like, wow, I could stay in this job the rest of my life. That's enough money for me to live on. I'm fine. I can do radio forever.
And so that seemed like a good opportunity. But as I mentioned at the top, You also spent time in Boston and Phoenix. Talk about those stops.
Yeah, I went to Boston from Charlotte. Charlotte worked out really well. I did. They wanted me to do an afternoon show that was like a morning show, and I did, and it went really well. We were the only show in Charlotte on FM that did any significant personality radio. I don't know why more people never did that or do that, but it worked out great. We were number one our first book, and
that's impressive. Just off to a
start. And so WAF in Boston, which is a great frequency. Opie and Anthony worked there. Bob Rivers worked there. A lot of people worked there. And I knew it was a great job. Bob and Zip were doing the morning show, and Bob Rivers left to go to Baltimore. And so they needed a partner for Zip. And I went up there and interviewed, and I thought, this is going to be great. I loved Zip. I loved the station. It was an album-oriented rock station. It was just what I wanted to do. And so that was how I got there from Charlotte.
I have questions about the Drew and Mike Circa WRAF. And like I mentioned to you, we'd be here all day, but I earmarked more than a few of my memories of your show with Mike on 101, first and foremost. How and when did you get hired in and brought to WRAF? Talked about.
Okay, we were in Phoenix for 2.5 years, and we got fired on a Sunday. I'll never forget coming back from vacation. We have a meeting at the station at 5 o'clock. And I called Zip, and Zip's like, yeah, we're blown out. And Bob Rivers, Zip's friend, who he had worked with forever, said, yeah, somebody's interviewing for your job. He told us that a couple months earlier. We just thought, there's no way. We're doing great. We had no idea. Anyway, blown out. So we started sending out tapes again, and we had just been out there 2.5 years earlier. A lot of people knew us, and Ken Calvert had left WRAF for Wheels, and they really thought Ken's connection to sports were important. His Pistons job, he had Jim Arnold on the air, he had Eddie Murray on the air. He did a lot of great sports. Ken was great. And they thought that his sports element was important, and I was had a great knowledge of sports. And so I think that's what helped me get the job. And Zip and I came in.
That's okay. Let it go, Drew. It's fine.
Zip and I came in to work with Lynn Woodison, and Lynn quit the first day.
Really?
Yeah. So Trudy was hired. Trudy was somebody that they knew and they liked. And so they said, well, we've got somebody. We thought this might happen. And so Lynn was very miserable about Ken leaving, I think. And she didn't know us.
Right.
You know, I don't really blame her.
Sure. Well,
So then Trudy came in, and Zip had some problems at the time. And Mike had been signed up too. When Ken took the job at Wheels, they did a really smart thing. They said, okay, well, he may leave, but he's not taking Mike Clark. Mike had been doing voices for his show, Mr. Stress.
Right, because didn't he work for Detroit Edison at the time, and he was doing some phoners, right?
Exactly. And Ken was just paying him. He might have been paying him out of his pocket. I think the station started paying him. And they said, this guy's really funny. We're going to hire him full-time. And they hired Mike full-time. They're like, whoever comes in is going to work with Mike as a voice guy. And Lynn. And so Zip and I came in. We got on famously with Mike right away. And then when Zip's life was going sideways, so Zip got fired. The ratings weren't good. And they put Mike in to fill in Zip's place to be a full-time co-host. And Mike and I knew each other very well by then. It was just a matter of Mike getting comfortable with being Mike, which took, I'd say, a year and a half or so. And then it just, when it happened, it just blew up. It just happened all at once. It was like we went from, 15th to, fifth. And then the next book, we were number one. And it just was, from there, it was just all good. It really was.
Before we go any further, I think it's a good time. You were talking about sports a minute ago. I think it'd be a good time to interject this. So Terry Foster, I sat down to interview him for my documentary, and he said some very nice things about you. And what he was saying, I concur, and that's why I put that at the top about you being on the Mount Rushmore. Terry was talking about how good you are in the sense that you could talk about a subject, and then you could talk about it again, get angry about it, talk about it again, and laugh. And you would just chew a subject from four or five different perspectives, and which I think is what makes you so talented behind the mic. Is that something that you learned early on, or is that something you developed? Because bringing, especially you mentioned Mike. Mike was raw, but you were very polished.
I think, I think Mike and I referred to that as mining for gold. You know, you just kind of look at a subject from this side, from that side, And eventually you get to what's really funny about it or what's really worth talking about it. And then you're on. And sometimes it doesn't quite get there. And it's like, well, let's move on from this. We've exhausted this. But that's what I think talk radio allowed us to do, was to really examine a subject hard and get it from this angle, that angle, until we found out which way it worked or what part of it was funny.
And you mentioned early on it was the three of you, you, Mike, and of course, Trudy. When did you guys know you were onto something? Was it the OJ coverage or was it before that?
I think the OJ trial solidified us. We were already really strong then. We were already number one. I think the OJ trial was so big and we covered it so hard. And I can't tell you how many people said, I'm so sick of OJ. Stop talking about OJ. And then they would go, and by the way, he's guilty or not guilty.
Right.
And we just were stubborn about it. We're like, no, this is huge. We're not going to stop covering this. And we would go home and, California is 3 hours behind. So the trial would be starting the day
right.
when Mike and I got home from Riff, and both of us watched it. We called each other back and forth, and we knew that trial inside out, and we spent a lot of time on it.
Was it the OJ trial that you think took your show to the next level? Because at some point, and I can't remember what year, your show was must listen to. I mean, everybody was listening to it.
I think that was a big deal. I do. I think it was a big part of it. I don't really think about it that often. People always remember the 9/11 show.
I'm going to ask you about that.
That was much later. We were on the air 8 hours that day, and that was a big deal. And that was one of those things that, probably solidified the show. But OJ was much earlier. That was, we'd only been there 3 years and 7 or 8 months at that point. So I think that was a huge deal, and it went on and on and on. It took a long time, and then took a while for the jury, and then there was a reaction to that, and that spawned a lot of activity. And I think we, to our credit, I think we covered it harder than anybody.
Yes.
We knew that trial. It wasn't like we were just hackers talking about it. We really spent time on it.
Yeah. Who was the witness you eventually had on the show? The guy who lived behind him. Oh, what was his name?
Oh, Cato Kalin.
Cato Kalin. Oh my gosh. He was, for a while there, he was like a fourth host on your show. You guys had him on so much.
We brought him in. And that was because, I don't know how, I'm trying to remember, was that, I think Podell, I can't remember if it was Greg Osham or Doug Podell, honestly, that brought Cato in. And, because they thought, we should do something big. You guys are spending so much time on this. We should bring someone in. And somehow they got in touch with somebody and offered him some money to come in. And he took it, and we were like, what, really? He's going to come in? and we had literally a lot, like, security for him, picking him up at the airport, taking him to the hotel. He was so – it was like the sight of him, just people would surround him. He was such a famous person at the time, and everybody wanted to know what he really thought.
Right.
So by the time we had him on the next day at the Royal Oak Music Theater, nobody had gotten to him. We had him all to ourselves. And, of course, we just bludgeoned him. He's guilty. He did it. Come on, Cato, spit it out.
And
he really wouldn't spit it out. He'd give you a little something, to make you feel better. He'd throw you a little meat, but he would not say he was guilty, which I think now he does.
Right. Well, it's interesting because that was a very polarizing trial in the sense that, there was no middle ground. You either thought he was guilty or you were adamant that he's innocent.
Absolutely. I don't think our audience, it was terribly polarizing. I think most of our audience thought he was guilty.
Right.
We did have that maybe 10%, and they'd get really angry, and you'd hear from a lot of people who, shut up, stop talking about it, you're wrong. But I think we got it right.
Yeah, you did.
And it was a fascinating year. It really was. I mean, that was incredible.
That was awesome. Awesome radio, no question. Now, speaking of Shut Up, about 3 or 4 years ago, I'm flipping through Pluto on my streaming service, and I come across this documentary, and I'm like, I remember this. I remember Drew and Mike talking about Shut Up, Little Man. That was another great. You guys talked about that. I don't know. It must have been a year. Shut up, Little Man. How did you come across, much like everybody else does, they would come through cassette tapes of these two guys that lived on the East Coast, right? They were roommates or something?
They lived in San Francisco.
That's right, West.
And this is such a great story. They were two roommates. One of them was gay and the other one was not, which I think a lot of people are confused about that. Peter Haskett was gay. Ray was not gay, but they were both heavy drinkers and they argued all night long. And the reason there were recordings of them arguing is because their neighbor could not get the landlord to do anything about them. So he hung a microphone out the back porch onto their side and recorded their
argument. And they knew it. They found the record. They knew they were being recorded. They didn't care.
Eventually they did, but he had a lot of material. And then he started making phony phone calls to them, too. Doing surveys on stuff that he heard them arguing about. And then he would ask a question that would incite whoever he was talking to, Ray or Pete. And you'd get this hilarious phony phone call. But yeah, Mike Clark fell in love with those tapes.
He was so good. You know, when you guys were documenting, playing these, I mean, between Drew Mike and his between Butt Mike and his comments, that shut up, little man, it was great.
No, Mike always complained that we didn't play Ray and Pete enough. We played a ton of Ray and Pete.
Yeah, you always did.
Wanted to play more. And they would spend, because it took a lot of time to bleep that stuff.
I bet.
It would take, you know, hours to get, 20 minutes bleeped. And eventually they'd get it so it was airworthy. And yeah, that was a great bit. It's funny. I very few people mention that. That was a great bit that nobody else had. And okay, that's enough, girl. And yeah, it was one of those silly things that really, really worked for us.
Yeah. If you want to be entertained and find your streaming service in the documentary, I think is called Shut Up Little Man. And it's from the perspective of the gentleman who, because it's the story's fascinating even beyond those two guys, because they tried to make it a movie and a play and it became a big thing. And yeah, Shut Up Little Man is the documentary. I highly recommend you check it out. Another thing that Drew and Mike was known for.
By the way, there's two documentaries about Shut Up Little Man.
Okay.
And we were going to be in one that these people did from Australia. They got a government grant to do a documentary on Ray and Pete. We sat down for, I would say, 3 hours talking to them. And we found out that the documentary had taken this turn that they had, it was being edited in a way that suggested that all these people were trying to rip off Ray and Pete.
Oh,
and we were two of them. And I don't know if that ever got out, but we were so mad. We spent all that time with those guys and then they did that to us, but whatever.
Yeah, I've seen that done many, many times. People under false pretenses, they get you involved and then they make you look like the bad guy.
Yeah, nobody loved Ray and Pete more than we did.
Oh my gosh. And your listeners. Yes, another famous segment from the Drew and Mike show, and I have to tell you, my favorite is after you'd been talking him a while and you guys called him on April 1st, Delbert Harris gave you guys the business. Why you guys keep calling me? The Harris polls, and you guys found Delbert Harris, and talk about what he meant to your show over the years.
We did these polls, the Harris polls. We called people named Harris to get their opinion on something. I don't know what it is about the name Harris, but it seems like it's an old name or something. We got a lot of old people would answer the phone. Maybe that's because those are the only people that answered landlines at that point. But we got Delbert in Arkansas because calling south was generally better than calling north or Midwest. Midwest, you get very Midwestern people. They're right. Just not quite, they're a little more skeptical.
Yes.
They're not as colorful. And Delbert had this Southern accent. And the first time we called us, he told a story about a guy who lost his arm in an accident at the factory and would drive around on the loader or whatever with a cigarette and a cup of coffee in his hand. And told the funniest stories. We're like, we got to call that guy back. And so we started calling him, and he just loved popping off about what was going on in the news. He paid attention. He watched the news. And he became so big that when we brought him to town, we did an event at the...
You took him to Frankenmuth, right? Yeah.
At the State Theater at the time. It's now the Fillmore. And that place had a line around the block.
Yeah.
I mean, it was sold out. Totally sold out.
You made him a celebrity. Yeah.
It was huge, yeah. And people desperately wanted his 8x10. They wanted him to sign it. And he was so beloved by the audience. It was really just a total fluke. And... you know, I got to give us a little credit on that one. I mean, we recognized it. And then, you know, Podell and them were like, well, we got to bring him to town. And, you know, credit to them for doing that, because that was a big deal.
Yeah, I was looking for a lot. I'm sure there's stuff out there, because there's a lot of Drew and Mike stuff out there, but I couldn't really find any of the cuts. But I did find on YouTube, you can go and find where you guys took him to Frankenmuth. And he looked like he was in heaven, you know?
Yes. We went to the casino in Windsor too. And he loved that. I mean, he blackjack just blew his mind. The fact that, you know, he could put a bet down and they'd give him money back. He just couldn't believe that.
That is great. Well, I mentioned, do you remember the call on April Fool's when he gave you the business, like after he'd been talking to you a while and he gave you some grief about keep calling him? Were you guys buying that? Was that for radio?
No. I think we were very confused. We're like, what the hell is going on? I didn't even think we were thinking that it was April Fool's Day when we called. We just happened to call him, I think.
Yeah. But he was like, why are you calling me? This is why you quit bothering me. You're bothering this old man. Yeah. But no, he was another great one.
When he started laughing, it was like, oh my God, what a relief. Cause he was a valuable entity to us.
One of the things you guys got famous for was finding celebrities at hotel rooms and calling them. One of my favorite, Andy Dick. The interview you guys with Andy Dick. What do you remember about that one? Because talk about an interesting guy.
Yeah, you know, Andy Dick has lasted through WRIF 105.1, where I did sports radio for 2.5 years, and the podcast, too. He still takes our calls, and he's still nuts. And, you know, I don't remember calling him in the hotel that much. I'm trying to remember what happened. Maybe you can refresh my memory.
No, that was a segue because you guys used to call. I remember calling celebrities, but Andy Dick was something. But yeah, you guys were famous for getting famous people on either by in advance or by surprise.
We got OJ before the OJ murders happened in Atlanta. He was down there for the Super Bowl and, we just started talking to him, and we clearly woke him up. And I said, yeah, Costas and them are already down there eating breakfast, OJ. What's going on? And he thought about it for a second. He's like, what are you talking about? And he hung up on us. I remember Bob Probert hung up in our face. Chris Farley hung up in our face. Chris Farley was the sleepiest human being I've ever heard answer phone. Yeah, we did. We called a lot of people in hotels. We got a lot of people at the Super Bowl because we would always find out what hotels the Super Bowl teams were in. And then our strategy became, and this is so stupid, but it honestly, I think it did work to some degree. We would call up and mispronounce the person's name. Like we didn't know who they're like,
right.
Is Brett Favre there?
Favre, yeah. Or,
I remember some were famous too, like Tony Surag USA. Did you have a Tony Surag USA? Do you have a Joe the Isman there?
Yeah, way before Key and Peele were doing Aaron, you guys were doing that.
And we'd say, I don't think we can put that through. And say, well, I have a package for him. It's supposedly very important. I don't know what it's about. I don't know who this guy is, but I really have to get him this package. And then they would get nervous that, you know, oh, shit, we're going to be the cause of him not getting something he desperately needs for the Super Bowl. And they put us through. And we talked to a lot of people at the Super Bowl. I can't think of what my favorite call was. I know we called Yancey Thigpen of the Steelers when they were down there. And he actually apologized to Detroit for dropping a pass the previous season that kept the Lions out of the playoffs. And we got some news out of that. So that was fun.
Another thing that you guys covered, obviously it happened in Detroit, but the Kerrigan, Nancy Kerrigan and Tonya Harding thing, that had to be great radio. You had to be, you know, chomping at the bit to talk about that.
Yeah, we did. We spent a lot of time on that. We produced a lot of fake commercials about it. I'm trying to remember, was the Tonya Harding securities or something? Or
to this day, I think Nancy
Eckert.
Yeah, Sean Eckert. But to this day, I think Nancy Kerrigan is mostly despised, and especially anybody listening to Drew and Mike, because in that you kind of made Tonya the victim. It was great.
Why? Why? You know, why me? And yeah, we did. After a very short time after that, we decided that we liked Tonya better than Nancy. In spite of what she'd done,
right.
She was a more likable person. You know, she drove four-wheelers. She's a little nuts. You know, she might throw an ashtray at you once in a while, but she sounded like a lot more fun. And Nancy was such a prima donna.
Yeah, Tonya was someone that I probably grew up with in East Point. You know, that was my people, you know?
No, I think Tonya probably would be fun to hang out with. Nancy Kerrigan, I'm sure we weren't fair to her. And then she was in the Disney parade, and she said she was caught on a microphone saying, "This is the most stupidest thing I've ever done." And of course, we could not stop playing that.
That's funny. Now, there's a couple. I got a clip, and I hope this isn't cringeworthy, but this is something that I think if there's a Mount Rushmore for Drew and Mike bits. This would be on it. Take a listen.
And we talked to another man who said that he was looking for someone to make the page. So apparently it's you.
Okay.
It's Belfer Blows.
Balfour Blow?
Yes.
Mr. Balfour Blow?
Yes. Yes. He just paged me, and apparently it might be time for my dialysis. I'm not sure.
Okay.
Something like that.
Okay, let me see if I can locate him then.
Please page.
Page him?
Yeah,
yeah, please page. Please
page. Page.
Yeah, those donut shop terrorism, obviously there was a lot of funny ones, but I remember almost getting an accident when you guys played Balfour Blows. That was, to me, the funniest one. But you guys did, every time Detroit was playing, especially in the playoffs, you would call donut shops. Talk to me about how that started and how that developed, and that had to be one of your favorite bits, wasn't it?
It was, you know, and it was one of those things that I think I've aged out of. It's it was during... I want to say that was when Beavis and Butthead were really big.
Yes.
And they were doing just the most ridiculous phony phone calls, and people would laugh. It was like really stupid humor was very in at the time. And I think that's why we started doing it. We just tried it and it worked. And it was like, oh, well, let's do that next time, you know? And so we started doing it, and then people expected us to do it. And it worked out so well. And I found out too that, like, in that case, didn't I say something about he needs his dialysis?
Yes, he needs his dialysis.
No. I found out that I was the most relentless liar when I wanted something. It's like, what happens to me? I'm like a sociopath on these calls.
But it was funny because it was almost like Pavlov's dog for humans. Every time I heard that ding, it made me laugh. The ring of the bell made me laugh because it was so funny. That they would say Balfour Blows or Kramer Blows or whatever the case was.
Yeah, it was probably so overdone, and yet people still demanded it. And it, you know, long past the time that it entertained us, we kept doing it. And I think we tried making it more and more ridiculous, and people would always somehow satisfy us. But we actually did it so many times that we would run into donut shops, like in Philadelphia or somewhere, they go, oh, I know who you guys are.
Yeah. but you know, it was a different time. And I went back and listened to some of those clips, and there's no way, especially some of the stuff Mike said, that you would be able to get away with today. Mike Clark would be canceled in 2023.
Yeah, I'm not sure what you're referring to exactly, but...
Well, just some of the guy talk type of stuff. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I suspect so, and that's probably one of the reasons radio is in such bad shape right now, is because people are probably scared to death.
Well, you asked me for an example, Aaron Brockovich, when you guys would do the Cliff Note Theater. That stuff.
Yeah.
It was, you know, it was hilarious. I was listening to it, and I still, you know, I'm 54 now. I'm not that demo anymore, but I still laugh. I still thought it was funny.
Yeah, we spent a lot of time on those. Those are very funny. We made a CD of them, and we sold a lot of copies. And but you're right. And you know, I was listening to your promos for your documentary before I came on with you today, and it was interesting listening to the part where these station owners were like, well, yeah, we've got this stupid FM thing nobody cares about, and let's let these hippies have it, you know?
Yeah.
And so then they turn it into ratings gold, and then they're like, oh, my God, it sounds so much better. Why aren't we making some money off this FM thing?
Right.
And FM to AM, to me, I think it's similar to podcasting to radio now. It's like, how are these local stations who can't fully express themselves without fear of being canceled, can't swear,
right,
have to be very cautious. They're forced to play tons of music, the same music over and over again. How can they compete with, like, the best, most talented comedians in the world who are doing podcasts?
Right.
Podcasting to radio now, to me, is like FM to AM back then.
Yes.
There's no way radio can compete with all the talent that are doing stuff on YouTube or on iTunes or podcasting or what have you. I mean, it's just insane. And it's sad. I think radio could do much better, but it's a pretty tough game.
It is. Well, you mentioned it earlier. I want to ask you specifically about you and Mike's coverage of 9/11. That was at the beginning of my career. I was at a station called KMAG in Ludington, Michigan, and I remember being on the air for 10 hours. That was my first year in radio, and I remember listening to some of your coverage. Some of my friends back here in Detroit would tape it, and man, good stuff. I mean, talk to me about what was going through your head, because you can't necessarily do your bits. You can't be funny. This is a serious thing. How did you go? Do you remember that day? What can you tell me about what you remember about your coverage of 9/11 on the Drew and Mike show?
I remember it very well. I remember the first plane,
and just, oh, wow, that's crazy. And I, Mike Clark, you know, being a pilot, Mike was so great to have in the studio that day because, you know, you see these pilots that are always experts on NBC or ABC or whatever. And I always, you know, we used to make fun of them. Mike was always jealous of them. So he would always say they suck. And we would always rag Mike about, you know, how easy it was to be a pilot. Right. And, you know, why do you think he was so special? But Mike was really good. He really knew the subject matter. And when that first plane went in, Mike said, that's not an accident. That's nuts. And I think we moved on from there. And then when the second one hit, it was like, oh, this is terrorism. This is crazy. This is absolute terrorism. We're under attack. There's no way anyone, I mean, you would have to try to hit that building with a commercial jet. There's right. no way. And Mike recognized it was a commercial jet early. And it, one of the things that's fun to listen to back, and a lot of people do listen to those, they're easily available on YouTube, is how many things Mike was right about.
Right.
And you know, we're playing TV coverage at the time too, and they're saying, oh, gee, I don't know if that's a commercial plane. Mike, yes, it's a commercial plane. It's absolutely a commercial plane. And he was very sharp. And I'd been reading a lot about terrorism at that time. I don't know why, but I had, and I correctly predicted it was Osama bin Laden, which was a little bit lucky because of a book I had just read. And Clinton had tried to get Osama bin Laden a few years earlier and had declined. And that whole story was a very complicated story. But I think there was a lot of serendipity with Mike being a pilot and just my reading interest. But I thought we did. I'm really proud of the job we did. And I listened to some of Howard Stern's 9/11 coverage. And honestly, I liked ours better. I you know, I don't know if it was better. And I'm not saying we're better than Howard Stern. Obviously, he had the biggest radio career you could ever have. But I was very happy with ours.
Yeah. I also wanted to ask you, because we had talked, was there anything, like, whether it be 9/11, 9/12, when did you, we can go back to regular programming, or was it just kind of gradual? Because that was, I remember there was a lot, I mean, SNL, I think, canceled a couple shows, and I think David went off the air for a while. Do you remember, yeah. What was that like?
There was so much to talk about 9/11, that honestly, I don't think we needed to go back to regular radio anytime soon. It was, I want to say maybe within 3 days or so, we probably started to drift back, but it so dominated the news. It was such a huge event. And it's really, you know, when the anniversary comes up to me, I feel bad about it because I'm like, wow, people just don't remember how serious that was. I mean, that was insane. It feels like it just happened, but you know, I remember my dad saying the same thing about Pearl Harbor. So it's just a matter of a function of time, you know, and not being alive or not being old enough to appreciate it at the time. Unfortunately,
I think we as people were maybe a little bit naive pre 9/11, and I think we grew up a lot after 9/11, either good or bad. But I think some of that naivete went away after 9/11. Would you agree with that summation?
Yeah, definitely, absolutely. No, it was a searing event. It was a humongous event, and feels like nothing is quite the same since. And in other ways, you know, I'm glad our eyes are open to certain things. But, you know, oh my God, international politics—it's so complicated, and having these military bases all over the world, and you know, the fact that this guy pretty much came unglued over the fact that we had a base in Saudi Arabia—you know, that had a lot to do with it. It's so complex. I don't think it can be solved. I mean, it's virtually impossible. It'll just continue to be a bugaboo, and hopefully you can just keep it at bay. What else can you do?
Another thing I want to, you mentioned earlier about going long, you guys broke the mold a lot as far as doing morning shows. And I want to ask you, how often, if at all, did you ever get called to the mat by one of your PDs? Doug Podell was your PD for a long time, but what other PDs did you have in your stint there at Riff?
Greg Osham was our PD. Jim Pemberton was the PD when I was hired. Jim Pemberton and Bob Shute was the GM. And, you know, they were great. I really liked them. And I was sorry they lost their jobs. And I think if we had been able to succeed sooner, you know, they would have lasted. I'm sure they would have. Greg came in. And the one thing I'll say about Greg Osham is that when we started Greater Media bought Great American, and we were flailing. WRF was not doing that well. And it took about a year for that sale to go through. And while that sale was going through, everybody was just looking out for number one. And there wasn't a lot of
heavy management. It was like, oh my God, what's gonna happen?
Right.
And what happened to me is I'm like, well, we're just gonna stop playing all this music. We're gonna just blow this show up. And we went from, you know, 6 songs to 5 songs to 4 songs to 3 songs.
No
to
songs.
No songs. And to Greg Oshin's credit, he said, that's what you need to do. That's what will help this station get out of this rut it's in, is if a morning show blows up. And he had seen it with, I think it was Bob and Brian in Milwaukee. And he was a very aware radio guy about some of the other shows like Stern and some of the shows in Chicago and some of the other markets. Bob and Tom in Indianapolis were another one. There were very few talking morning shows at that time on FM. I mean, there were just 4 or 5, and we were one of them.
What kind of reception did you, and go back to the early years of Riff, what kind of reception did you get from some of the other jocks? Because you joined pretty much an all-star team. You mentioned Ken Left, but Arthur P. was there, Steve Costan was there, Doug Podell. These were legends in Detroit. Did they accept you, or how did that, walk me through that transition, or were they just like, what's this guy about?
I think there was kind of like, who are these guys from Phoenix? You know, what is that? But I think they pretty quickly accepted us. I think we passed the test with our show for the most part. Steve Costan was on after us. Steve was a huge help. Steve, you know, any kind of pronunciations or, you know, localisms, he was really great about helping me, you know, learn those things, and took me to a Michigan football game and, you know, really helped me get on board. And by the way, I thought Steve was great in middays. I liked him in that day part. Now, I was sorry that, you know, that didn't work out, and he ended up at CSX and he had a fine career and all that. But I thought he was fantastic, and he's walking encyclopedia of music. And so we had a lot of fun crossing over with him. Arthur took me out when we came to interview. He took me to Trump's, of course, on 8 Mile.
And I just, we're going to go to the club. Like, come on.
Yeah. I just remember thinking, how does everyone at this club know this guy? This is really kind of weird. I mean, he knew everyone. And I think he took us to another strip club and he knew everyone there. And I just thought, wow, that seems really odd that he knows all these people. He must be a legend in this town. I mean, I just didn't know that he was a legend at going to strip clubs too. I didn't realize that, but
I remember
Arthur was very gracious, and Steve was, and they were cool. But I think there were, you know, certainly there was a period of time where they, you know, you've got to show your chops, and once we did that, it was all pretty good.
What about from the listeners? At a certain point, you mentioned the Red Wings had a lot to do with people listening to you guys because your coverage of the Red Wings and all that stuff. But talk to me about when you went out in public and like, oh, this is a different animal here. People know us and they love us, and it's we're creating a scene. Was that weird for you?
Yeah, it was odd because, you know, when we started, we were from out of town, and there were a lot of people. Bob Talbert did a story about how, oh, out of town morning shows can't succeed here. And he did a list of the out of town morning show graveyard, all the out of town shows that had failed, and then said, you know, maybe it'll be different for Drew and Zip and Mike, but I don't know. And so that was a real narrative. And of course, I'm sure local people love that because it probably keeps people from out of town from coming in. But I always felt that, hey, listen, if people in Detroit can like the Simpsons aren't from Detroit. Yeah. Married with Children wasn't from Detroit, and people watched that. So it wasn't, I think it was a misnomer. I just think those weren't great shows that came in and failed.
Talk to me about, go ahead.
I thought people were generally very nice. I mean, yeah, your first few days, it's always shitty. I mean, you have to ignore that. We changed markets enough that we knew coming in that, you know, people are vicious right off the bat. You know, you suck, go back to where you came from. You don't belong here. Got the same, actually, at WAF in Boston, because Zip had been there before, it was really easy. It really helped the transition. And that's what Lynn Woodison was supposed to do, but Lynn quit. That was gone.
And that was good because Trudy Daniels became Trudy Daniels. How important was she to that show from your purview?
She was great because Trudy doing the news, our show was a lot about the news and commenting on the news. And so I think she was great at picking stories, and, you know, she didn't always agree with necessarily what we were talking about. So she probably related to a lot, or a lot of people probably related to the fact that, you know, they didn't agree with us. Not that she always disagreed by any means,
But and she was willing to have fun. You know, we had a listener come in and suck her toes one morning.
That's
not
great.
Not every person's willing to do that.
Yeah.
So she was a gamer, and you know, she could laugh at a dick joke. And there's plenty, believe me, plenty of news females that will not and don't want any part of that. And I think they're pretty closed-minded myself.
Yeah.
But Trudy was Trudy can take a joke, and Trudy will make a good joke. So, no, she fit beautifully.
And another one, forgot to mention Mr. Methane. That was another one that you guys had on there all the time. That brilliant radio.
And we brought him to town, and people were around the block to see Mr. Methane fart. And he was a great showman. He had a fantastic show, and people loved it. But, yeah, we took him to Red Wing game. We had a great time with him, and Barrymore Barlow was his manager, and Barry had played drums for Jethro Tull, and he started representing artists later on, and he was a great guy. I went over to London and actually saw Barry at his house. Great guy. And Mr. Methane came in, and we had a great time. He's just a lovable guy. He really is.
Well, they say all good things must come to an end, and I document, I think in episode 4, that you guys, number one in the market, they don't bring you back. Talk to me about leaving WRI, because I remember that was, I listened to that whole program, and one of the things that I loved about your show is the goodbyes every day. It was this long 2-minute clip of, you know, coolness aside, yeah. I'd like to say thank you and all that stuff, and thank you to Detroit and all that, and you guys, I know like the last 20 minutes, it was almost like there's nothing here. They just don't want to say goodbye. But talk about why you guys didn't come back. They didn't renew your contract, and they brought in some other group, some these other guys that are still on there now. But not a fan. I'm not a fan.
Yeah, I it's interesting. I didn't listen to Dave and Chuck for a long time just because I was pissed or just upset. I wasn't really mad at WRAF. We had a great time there. They were good to us. We made a lot of money. I mean, how can you complain about 22 years? I just wasn't that sour about it. Dave and Chuck went off the air at 89X 6 months before they started at Riff, and their non-compete was being enforced. And first it was like, oh, where are they going? And I want to say about 4 months into their 6 months, it dawned on me. I just thought, they're coming to Riff.
They're coming here.
They're coming here. Mike had been off the air for a while. He had some illnesses, and Mike and I were doing the show and doing it very well. I mean, that's one thing about the show. When somebody was out, people picked up, and or somebody was down.
Yeah, you were out with a back surgery. I can't imagine what that was like. You were out for a little bit too, right?
Oh yeah, I was out for a long time, twice. And that was one thing great about the show, is that those guys could pick up the slack. And whoever, you know, and when Mike was having health problems, people picked up the slack, and I had to pick up slack too, and people had to pick up slack for me. And I remember, it's funny, I remember listening to the show one day when I was off just for one day, and I remember listening to it and thinking, God, this show sounds good. I mean, I was like, kind of pissed in a way.
Right.
I was like, they shouldn't sound this good. They sound like they're having a ball. But, you know, when you have that many talented people, they want to show their stuff when they have a chance. And so, God bless them, they did. But a couple months before Dave and Chuck were announced, honestly, I started thinking, they're coming to Riff. They're coming to Riff. They're not talking to us about a new contract. And this is weird, because they always do before this. And I just had a feeling. And then I was told that, you're going to sports radio at 105.1, and they are coming to do the morning show. And I sat on it for a couple days and was like, oh, God, what are they doing? And I knew the PD at the time liked Dave and Chuck a lot, because you talk about him, and I think he listened to him, and I think it all sort of came together in my head. And I just remember the first thing I said back after it absorbed was, can we stay on Riff somehow? I mean,
right.
Some way we can be on Riff, you know, what can we do the middays and we do the afternoons? And it was like, no, you will do sports radio and you will be paid well for doing it. And Mike will not do sports radio. And Mike wasn't a sports guy. It would have been silly. And so I just had this terrible feeling in my stomach. Honestly, I thought, I don't want to do sports for 4 hours a day. I didn't want to do it. But if I'd been smarter, I would have started podcasting right then. because we could have made the transition right. more easily, and we could have moved a lot of people to the podcast right away.
But to be fair, podcasts weren't what podcasts are now. I mean, that you would have had to.
No, they weren't.
It was a different thing.
But we did still have a lot of power, and I think a lot of people might have figured it out sooner because, you know, it would have been a big deal if we had done it right then. Instead, I went to sports radio.
And who else was there? It was you. They brought in a bunch of big names along with yourself. Wasn't some people from DFN came over? Like, wasn't it like an all-star station, or was that what they were trying to make it?
No.
No?
It was not. They took Mike and Mike from ESPN in the morning, and honestly, Mike and Mike, they're probably great, but they were rated like 21st in Detroit. Detroit is not big on syndicated shows, right. and they were not Mike and Mike, and 97.1 killed them. We were fourth or fifth in the afternoon generally. I think when we started out, we were 18th from the Magic days, and we pretty quickly got to fifth or fourth, and I think we stuck around there. I think we were second a couple times behind Mike Valeni, but it was a losing battle because the show we were following was 16th or 17th, and the morning show was 21st. It was like, and then we went off, and it was all syndicated. Like Friday, when we went off the air on Friday, you would not hear a local voice until Monday morning at 10 o'clock when Matt Derry came back on. And that's insane. Yeah. It was just a recipe for disaster, and their whole plan was to get the Red Wings and the Lions on, or the Red Wings and the Tigers on, and I think they outbid 97.1 and they gave 97.1 to match. And once 97.1 matched and took it, that was over. And I left.
You were only there for how long? Were you there? Not very long.
2.5 years. And when my deal came up, they said, we want you to do all sports. And I said, I'm not doing all sports because, honestly, it's the Drew and Mike-ish stuff that's building this audience.
Right.
There's no way I can do all sports. I would be punishing the audience. And they disagreed. They were like, no, we think you could Millennium run for his money. And I was like, no, there's no way. And so they said, well, then that's it. And I said, okay, that's it. That's fine. I really didn't like being there. I didn't want to be there. A lot of people tell me they love that show, you know, that, oh, no, I listened to that show. I really liked it. We put a ton into it. We really tried, but it just wasn't, that station just was not meant to be. But as far as Riff, I think they just thought that Dave and Chuck were the 18 to 34 show, and they were. I think they were beating us by a couple points at that time, 18 to 34. You know, 35 to 54, we were, I'm sure, well ahead of them. But they were just looking ahead, and, you know, they've done fine. Those guys have killed it. So, yeah. You know, how can anybody say they were wrong?
So talk to me about the Drew and Mike podcast. How did this start, and talk to me about how it's evolved, because it's huge.
Yeah, it's doing really well. When I left the sports station, I had a chance to go on back on radio, and I just really didn't want to get up in the morning mostly. And plus the money was disappearing. You know, it was a fraction of what I'd been paid. It was still good money, but I just felt like I'd rather try this. Let's just try it and right. see how it goes. And at first it was frustrating because it'd be like, oh, what time is it on?
Yeah.
And how do I get it? And it was just, you know, people weren't listening to that many podcasts, but within 2 or 3 years, the number of people listening to podcasts just skyrocketed. And, you know, it went from being a really loyal audience that found us quickly to a much bigger audience as we got a little bit of publicity here and there. When Mike Clark died, I think our audience almost doubled because there was so much publicity about Mike Clark, and every story mentioned that we were doing this podcast.
Right.
And so that, I mean, and I'm sure Mike would be proud that it helped. Because of course it was big news when Mike died, and I think it's steady. I know that the Nerdist did a story on what is the most listened to local podcast in every state, and I was shocked to see Drew and Mike because I never believe any kind of surveys like that.
Right. Yeah.
Delighted to believe that, and I think I don't know what podcast in Michigan is bigger. If there is one, I don't think
there is. But you've brought a lot of local talent. Talk about some of the. I think Eli Zaret does some stuff with you. Who else do you guys bring into the show on a regular basis?
Eli Denny. What we did was when I started doing it, I thought, why don't we get some other people to, you know, make this bigger? And we got Charlie LaDoff.
Yeah, Charlie.
Patrick, and we got Eli, Denny, and Bob Page. We're doing a sports podcast, which I thought was excellent. It was a really fun show to listen to because it was three old sports guys who didn't give a damn, and they would say anything, and they would argue with each other. It was really fun to listen to, but they did that for about 3 years, and I thought that that would, you know, just there'd be some alchemy between the shows. We'd promote each other. It would help. And I think it did. But we when that sports show split up, Eli started doing something on Mondays for us on Monday morning to cover the sports of the weekend. Tom Mazzaway's on with us at the end of the week, and he kind of covers some sports things. And then in between, it's Mark Fellhauer, myself. Trudy is still with us. And Brandon, who produced us at 105.1 and was our intern at Riff for a long time,
he's
generally the producer, but we also have Jim Bentley fills in, Mike Walters fills in. He's got his own podcast.
Mike Walters is great.
Yeah, he just weeded three shows this week, and I thought they were great. So, yeah, it's like we've really got everybody back together except for Mike.
Look, if I'm on a treadmill or something like that, or I'm going for a drive, it's great to listen to your whole show. But what I love about what you guys do is you guys segment. It's almost like an itemized list. This is what we talk about, and you can kind of jump back. It was like, oh, I like this topic, but they're talking about this down here. And I love the presentation of the podcast, too. I think that helps, too.
Yeah, thank you. I like it in some ways. It's better than the radio show because there's so many less commercials. You'll never hear more than three in a row. They're never within 10 minutes or 20 minutes of each other. You know, after doing it, honestly, I still love to listen to 97.1 because I'm a big sports fan. And I'm always like, oh, my God, more commercials.
Right.
I'm used to, you know, just doing 3 hours and running 8 or 9 commercials in 3 hours. I mean, that's 2 or 3 an hour. That's not bad. And I'm just appalled at like, oh, my God, how can anyone listen to radio?
The commercials are forever. Yeah.
They're in such a tough spot now. It's difficult.
How fun has it been to do this podcast during this Lions run? I have to tell you, I hadn't watched a game since Barry Sanders was in a uniform. And I started tuning in when they were 1-6 last year. The first game I watched in its entirety, they went 2-6, and then we know what happened. But how fun has this been to talk about on your podcast?
I think it's been one of the best in terms of sports teams. I think it's been as fun as anything. It's as fun as the Red Wings run. It's as fun as the Tigers in 2006, which was unexpected. You know, everyone in Detroit loves this coach, and everyone was rooting for him. And then, you know, they did the Hard Knocks, and I think we got to know him even better. And like, this guy, we love him. Can right. he win football games? And yes, he can. And then we went into this year thinking, God, can they really build on this? And they could, and they did. And, you know, it was a really sad ending. But honestly, what a fantastic season. And the audience just went ballistic. I mean, you can't lose bringing up the Lions when they were on this run. You couldn't lose. There's no better topic to talk about.
I said this to Terry Foster. Even when the Lions were beating the Cowboys back in 91, that team, I mean, that Benny Blades and Spielman and all that stuff, I never felt as confident as far as them winning games as I have this last season and a half. When they lost to Carolina at Christmas time last year, I was like, what? Like, they just, it's shock. I have so much confidence in this team, and I really don't know where this criticism of Jared Goff comes from, because by everything I've seen, there's been a couple games during the middle of the season that he was like, okay, but this kid is fantastic.
Yeah, he's had a great run. He's really, I saw him called a game manager recently, and I was kind of offended by that. It's like, he's not a game manager. He reminds me of Tom Brady later. You know, Tom Brady, when he was younger, Tom could maybe run for a few yards here and there. He was a pretty good athlete, not a great athlete, but Goff reminds me of Brady in that he's so good at picking out the open guy.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's a game manager. I think of somebody who can't throw and just hands off and runs once in a while.
Right.
I think Jared Goff has done a fantastic job, and he's been to one Super Bowl already. I don't know why he can't get us to one.
I agree. Real quick, before I let you go, can you share one or two of your proudest moments from radio broadcasting or your podcast?
I thought the 9/11 show really was a great thing, and I didn't give it that much thought at the time, but over the years, so many people have mentioned it, and on some anniversaries, some people have contacted me to do stories about it, and so, yeah, that was great. And then also, I love winning stuff, and we won National Morning Show of the Year in 2003, 2004, and 2005, Radio and Records. That was, I was really happy about that because we had never won it before. And honestly, the guy that called me from Radio and Records to tell me we'd won said, "Wow, you sound really excited about this." And I said, "Yeah, we've never won anything before." And he goes, "Oh, sure you have." And I said, "No, no, we haven't." He checked. And he's like, "No, yeah, I guess you haven't." And he was surprised we never won before. But then we won it two more years after that. And I thought that was really cool. It was really nice to get recognized. We were nominated for a Marconi Award once and we didn't get it. So there's that. But
well, you know, I know
I still have the plaque.
I know Dick Purton and Fred Jacobs. Those two might be the only guys that I can think of locally. But I don't know why Drew Lane's not in the National Radio Broadcasting Hall of Fame. Has anybody approached you about that? Or,
well, you know what? People bring it up. Listeners bring it up. And I think it's because maybe I'm not in radio. You know, I noticed like this year, a lot of people nominated are people that are on radio now, which I think is kind of silly in a way. But I would love to be. And I see some people that are in it and I go, "Oh my God, if that guy's in,"
yeah,
you know, telling me we can't be in. But a lot of that is politics. I'm not going to blame politics for it, but seriously, you have to have somebody, I think, who really carries the ball for you, and not being on the air probably makes that hard. You know, is somebody going to say, "Oh, gee, I just realized," I don't know. I always thought that if you were good enough to be in something like that, that you would just get in.
Right.
But it's not that simple. Yeah. And so
maybe we'll start a petition. I think we should start a movement.
I can't. The thing is, I could probably start the ball rolling, but I feel like, oh God, I can't. That's just so gross. Yeah. I mean,
I think people need to pick up the mantle and do it for you. I'm going to look into that, Drew.
Somebody might do it. And if they did, I would be really excited. But you know, the damn thing is, you have to get. It's like the Rock and Roll. You have to get nominated, and then you have to win through the nomination. But
if Dolly Parton can get in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, for sure we can get freaking Drew Lane into the Rock and Roll Radio Hall of Fame. Come on.
Well, I do know this. Our audience would go crazy and vote for us because they're that way. And, you know, whenever the Our Magazine Best Podcast comes up, they'll all go crazy and remind everybody to vote. And Channel 4's Best Of. And, you know, we've won all that stuff with the podcast, which I'm really happy about that. That's exciting. And then one year we lost and some of them ended up berating the show that won.
Rightfully so.
And they ended up saying that, they want to kill us. And, you know, they want us off the air. And they were just kidding around, but they took it really seriously. So, our audience is they're very much in our corner, and I very much appreciate it.
I mentioned earlier you couldn't do some of the things that you guys did when Mike was still doing the show with you. But I asked Jim Johnson this a couple of weeks ago. How do you feel about the current cancel culture that seems to affect how people feel about radio personalities? What's your take on that?
I'm trying to think. The things that I've seen radio people lose their jobs for or get quote-unquote canceled for are usually so dumb that I go, I don't think I even really am worried about this person. You know, I'm just trying to think of a case where somebody got thrown off the air over doing something I thought was okay. And I just can't think of many like that. But I generally hate cancel culture.
I know you're still having a good time doing the podcast, but Drew, what's next for Drew Lane?
More podcasts. I can say that. And we're trying to get this YouTube channel going. I think we're the last show to get a YouTube channel in the entire world. I mean, everybody was doing their show on YouTube, and we don't do the show on YouTube, but we take a clip every day and we're trying to build that up. We got about 15,000 subscribers. So if you'll go to YouTube and push the subscribe button, that would be great. Or, Drew and Mike on any platform. Right now, just kind of still going on with the podcast. I don't know how long I'll be doing it or if I'll maybe stop at some point and then reboot later with another show, because I think I would like to maybe take some time off at some point in the near future. But I have a feeling there's another show coming after that.
Drew, I want to thank you for sharing your broadcast story. There's no quitting. I think I see many more years. You're going to do this as long as you want to, and people will tune in, I'm sure.
Well, yeah, and we'll send them all your way because they'll see this too, and they need to support Ron Robinson's Radio Days.
Appreciate
it. I wrote it down, I think, somewhere. I can see the documentary on Reveal, did you say?
Yeah, it's an interesting story because I went through a company called Film Hub, and the first company to license my series was Amazon Prime. And so they've since withdrew their license, but Reveal is a streaming service that's dedicated to independent filmmakers, which I'm very honored to be on there. But it's R-E-V-E-E-L. And then, of course, I got tired of waiting for Amazon Prime to license it again, so I just put it on Vimeo pay-per-view. So just put it out there. People can tune in for free on Reveal, or they can pay-per-view, rent it, or buy it through Vimeo at my website, RonRobinsonStudios.com.
Did you have to raise some money to put this thing together?
I paid for all this out of my own pocket. I spent just over $30,000 of my own money doing this.
Can you make it back?
I doubt it. I worked on it since it's a labor of love. My first interview was with Dick Kernan in 2014, and my last interview was with Ken Calvert, who I was fortunate enough to call a friend over the last couple of years of his life. That's been my paying, is the relationships that I've made in this journey. You mentioned the Lions. Last season, I watched all the games with Brian Pastore, the drummer from Adrenaline. So the relationships that I've made doing this has been the reward. But if I make a little bit of money, so be it. But this was more a labor of love. Right now, I want people to watch it. I think and take myself out of the equation, I think the 5 episodes is really, really good. I'm very proud of this project.
No, I want to watch it, and we'll certainly tell people about it.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Drew. I appreciate it.
Good luck with it.
Thank you. Thanks to Drew Lane again for checking out, and thank you as well for checking out Radio Days, the podcast. Today's podcast is sponsored by Radio Days, 101 Years of Radio, a new documentary series about the history of terrestrial radio, a little bit about podcasts as well. Here's a story from those who lived it, and you can watch the entire 5-part series, as we just talked about, on Reveal or at Vimeo. You can find that link at RonRobinsonStudios.com. You can also hear previous episodes of this Streamcast podcast there as well. And if you'd like to learn more about the series, go to RonRobinsonStudios.com. Thanks for checking out the show. Hope you enjoyed it. Until next time.
You can't go. All the plants are going to die.